This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Radio is everywhere.
Always accurate and precise.
Bloomberg's really one of the places that's reporting facts.
Your communication capabilities are wonderful for our business.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini on this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best.
Gita Gopinath of the IMF tells us we'll get inflation under control, but now, well, we have another problem.
We don't have any Chinas anymore that are growing at very high rates. So for the global economy as a whole, we don't have very large engines of growth.
ConocoPhillips CEO Ryan Lance on oil's staying power.
You cannot power our country on renewables alone. And you're going to need fossil fuels, and we're going to need it for a long period of time.
John Bolton says time to get tough on Russia.
A strong response is the only thing the Russians understand. And if we don't start now, Gershkovich could be in jail for a long time.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the week. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
One of the big questions we heard from a lot of people this week is, how worried should we be about inflation right now?
The great inflation isn't over until the Fed says it is, because they don't need to raise rates anymore.
Vincent Reinhart, chief economist at Dreyfus and Mellon.
Once we got a run in which inflation is close to goal and people don't care much about inflation, then it's behind us.
Well, we're sure not at that point where we don't care yet.
And we heard about that from Gita Gopinath, first deputy managing director of the International Monetary Fund.
And she tells Bloomberg's Tom Keene, Lisa Abramowitz, and Jonathan Farrell from the sidelines of the IMF and World Bank meetings, inflation is anchored for now, but she also says now we might have another problem.
If inflation expectations de-anchor, there are multiple problems associated with that. Firstly, interest rates go up. Policy rates have to rise much faster to bring inflation down. And that can generate much greater financial stress than we have seen, with consequences not just for the country where the tightening is happening, but if you're a large economy, it would spill over to the rest of the world. So that could be very consequential. And it's one of the downside scenarios we have in our world economic outlook, which is if interest rates have to go up much faster and you have much more tightening, you could end up with global growth going as low as, say, 1%, which is would be very bad.
So what is the nominal GDP separation of the IMF five-year forecast? Is it for a dropping disinflation, a lower inflation, and with it lower real GDP, bringing us down to a truly subdued nominal GDP?
No, we have our expectation is that inflation will be conquered in over time. It's not going to happen immediately. But if you go into 2024, you're going to see inflation around the world getting much closer to central bank targets. Real growth is going to slow also because we don't have any Chinas anymore that are growing at very high rates. So for the global economy as a whole, we don't have very large engines of growth. So that's generating the weakness in real growth, also because we have aging demographics. So unless we can find a way to raise productivity, you know, we are going to struggle with low growth.
How controversial has your call been that inflation is going to get back down to where it was, close to pre-pandemic even, by 2024?
You know, if you look at forecasts and if you look at market expectations in the U.S., you see an even more rapid fall in inflation that's expected. So we are actually on the side of being a little more cautious about how long it's going to take to bring inflation down. But we think the policies will work. There's been some very substantial increase in interest rates. We are seeing now that show up in terms of high-frequency data, this slowing of the economy, and we think that will bring down inflation. But it will take time.
Do you think that the balance of risk has shifted since what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank and with some of the other banking institutions and the huge drop-off in lending that we've seen peripherally in initial data, that the balance of risks has shifted to perhaps have monetary officials be a little less aggressive when it comes to rate hikes and to err on the side of pausing or even cutting?
Well, as always, central banks need to take into account how economic conditions look. And with the financial stress, you've had a tightening in financial conditions. Bank lending standards have tightened. Smaller banks' credit has weakened. And that will slow the economy down to some extent, which is why central banks may have to do less. But again, I think we're still waiting for more data to show up to know exactly how much of an effect that's had.
Geeta, there's a bit of tension between what the IMF has communicated this week and what politicians have responded with. Chancellor Hunt told us that he disagrees with your forecast. He's entitled to disagree with it. And he said he sees evidence of lending, bank lending, contracting in America. Secretary Yellen says she doesn't see evidence of that. How do you explain the daylight between what your institution is saying and what politicians are saying back?
So firstly, I think if you look at the numbers, we're not that far apart, right? So for instance, in the case of the UK, I think what Jeremy Hunt would recognize is that we've actually had a substantial upgrade for UK for this year. It's just that we haven't gone as high as maybe some of the other forecasts. But we've actually seen things turn out better than expected in the UK. In the case of credit conditions, again, I think the difference is that Tobias was pointing to all of credit supply, not just from the large banks. And so you see that in the smaller banks, you see certainly credit supply slowing. But if you look at the large banks, indeed, you know, credit is holding up.
So you don't believe the Treasury Secretary is misleading us when she says things like she doesn't see evidence of bank lending contracting?
I think that's the description that, especially if you look at large banks, you're seeing credit holding up is an accurate representation, again, of the data at this point.
That was Geeta Gopinath, First Deputy Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, with Bloomberg's Tom Keene, Lisa Abramowitz, and Jonathan Farrow on the sidelines of the spring IMF and World Bank meetings in Washington.
And also on the sidelines with us at David Malpass, outgoing president of the World Bank. And he tells Tom and John, it's all about debt right now, wherever you look, just kind of like during the financial crisis, but a little different.
There was a maturity mismatch going on then, too, and it maybe from the same causes. Remember, in the 2000s, interest rates were being raised very slowly, and so that built up a giant maturity mismatch, which some companies were funding with repos funding treasuries, so in treasury bonds. And so in that way, it harkens to now. We have in the U.S. banking system, some banks are funding treasury bonds with deposits. But a big difference now is the biggest duration mismatch is the Federal Reserve itself. It funds with uses overnight borrowing to fund a giant bond portfolio, some $9 trillion, the European Central Bank, $8 trillion. And I think the dominant feature now is the asset allocation that came out of that. If you have giant buyers of long maturity, of duration. In effect, the central banks were buying giant duration. And so what that meant is it distorted all world markets, and we're now in the workout phase. There'll have to be a normalization of interest rates. It means pressure on asset prices for a long period of time. That's what's showing up in the meetings here. The expectation that there'll be weak growth for a while puts pressure on people in developing countries throughout the world, and that pressure is getting intense.
Frame the distinction between the World Bank weak growth call and that of your colleagues at the International Monetary Fund. Both of you, to editorialize, have been grim. What's the Malpassian level of grim in your forecast?
Ours are a little weaker than the IMF's, but remember, they often do one in purchasing power parity. So if you adjust for that, there's not that much difference. We use market-based exchange rates, and so ours is 2, and theirs, I think, would work out to 2.4. So they're both weak forecasts for 2023, and that's showing up in the U.S. You saw the Federal Reserve saying maybe in the U.S. a recession, mild recession in the second
half.
Right,
and what's great about this is Malpass uses a slide rule from Colorado College Physics.
Oh, very cool. So this is growth. Let's talk about debt, if we can. This is something you've been really outspoken about, David, over the last few years. China, the world's biggest creditor to poor nations. I understand there's been some conversations this week. What's their position now, if we could start there? And then if you could tell me whether you're satisfied with it.
The debt has grown up over the years. The the composition of the debt is different from in the old days. That used to be U.S. banks that were lending to foreign countries. Now we have China and the euro bond market lending to developing countries, sovereign debt. So there was extensive talk. I co-chaired with Kristalina the debt roundtable. China came at the level of the PBOC governor and also the Ministry of Finance of China. And so they participate in the discussion. And there were some agreements. There was agreements that there needed to be more timeliness of the launching into a restructuring process, that there needed to be data sharing. China's asked from the beginning, can't we get the data earlier? That hasn't been the tradition, but that's going to be, and there's a paper to do that. Also a working group, which is important, on the technicalities of burden sharing. How do you have equal burden sharing among creditors so that they all participate in the restructuring process of the debt?
That was David Malpass, president of the World Bank, from the sidelines of the spring meetings of the World Bank and the IMF in Washington, with Bloomberg's Tom Keen and Jonathan Farrow. And coming up,
former President Trump's national security advisor John Bolton tells us it's time for the U.S. to get tougher on Russia.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Rising tension between the U.S. and China over Taiwan.
Yeah, there sure is. Dozens of Chinese fighter jets, as well as warships, detected near Taiwan this weekend. And Beijing is warning its forces are, quote, ready to fight if Taiwan seeks independence.
In helping trigger this latest tiff, Denise, a visit to California by Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen and then Republican Congressman Michael McCaul of Texas led a three-day delegation to Taiwan himself.
That's right, Ed. And McCaul is promising to deliver U.S. weapons he says Taipei has purchased.
And as the House Foreign Affairs Committee chairman, I sign off on all foreign military sales, including weapons to Taiwan. And I promise you, Madam President, we will deliver those weapons.
Meanwhile, a display of American firepower in Asia.
That's right, Major General Eric Austin this week, leading U.S. and Filipino forces in what's being described as the largest combat exercises in decades across the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait.
Philippine and U.S. forces are coming together in large numbers, approximately 17,600 participants in total, demonstrating our commitment to each other and to our mutual defense treaty.
And General Austin had also saying the U.S. and the Philippines do share what he calls an unbreakable bond.
Also shockwaves in the U.S. after Russia detained Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovitz and accused him of spying.
And Piotr Sauer is a friend of Gershkovitz.
This is just a huge shock for us because this is unprecedented. No one could really see this coming. Russia hasn't arrested a journalist on espionage charges since 1986.
Sauer is Russian affairs correspondent at The Guardian.
And Roger Karsten, special presidential envoy for hostage affairs, says a lot is going on in the background right now as the White House and State Department hope to get Gershkovitz released.
I think these things are best done in private. I don't want to negotiate in public. My fear is that if we start to show our hand and really what our strategy is, that will actually decrease the chances of bringing Evan home. So some of these things are best not discussed.
Karsten's there on Good Morning America.
And at John Bolton, former national security advisor to President Trump and former ambassador to the United Nations under President George W. Bush, talked to us about what's going on with China and Taiwan.
And Denise, he also tells Bloomberg's Tom Keene in a wide-ranging interview, the U.S. needs to push harder to get Gershkovitz out of Russia.
Look, this is obviously an entirely political decision by the Kremlin. They're taking this reporter hostage. They're accusing him of espionage. We know that's not true because it's been a long, long time since we've used reporters for that purpose in order to protect them from exactly this kind of thing. Clearly, the Russians want to exchange the reporter for something. But I think instead of pleading with him to let this hostage go, and he is a hostage in effect, I think we've got to declare the Russian ambassador persona non grata. I think we ought to go to our NATO allies and ask them to do the same, because it could have happened to any one of their journalists. A strong response is the only thing the Russians understand. And if we don't start now, Gershkovich could be in jail for a long time.
Ambassador Bolton, I want to continue this discussion, but because of time and such an ample news flow, we've got to move on. John Bolton, we have an intelligence leak. This is not Matt Damon, and I know Matt Damon was going to play the part of you in another movie. It's not the Bourne Identity. It's not paper under park benches and that. This is your world being affected by digital technology, digital media. Do we need to radically change our intelligence distribution because of new technology?
Well, I think there's a lot we can do to safeguard classified material better. And I would certainly say, based on what we know publicly, and we don't know whether we're at the end of it or not, it could be more. However, I would also caution at this point that we not draw too many conclusions.
I look at this, Ambassador. I'm going to do an audible here, and it's just a general question for the American public, not Republican, not Democrat. In your experience, how removed is the intelligence community's process in day-to-day grind from the way it's perceived by Hollywood? Is Hollywood accurate, or are they just off the mark on a movie-by-movie basis?
Well, the Hollywood movies are very exciting, and some of that does occur. But you know, we collect huge amounts of intelligence through what we call euphemistically national technical means, meaning electronic and other forms of surveillance. Frankly, we need a lot more human intelligence collection than we have. And we need a greater clandestine operations capability than we have. I think Puritans in the foreign policy establishment have looked down on clandestine operations for a long time. We're in a very dangerous world. We could use a lot more. Mm-hmm. But it's something I think Americans, if they really knew what our intelligence collection capabilities were, would be very proud of what we're able to do.
John Bolton, I want to move to the bipartisan thrust of Washington against China. Should we be cautious because there's such a fixed bipartisan nature to our anger over China? Do we overreact?
Well, I don't think we've overreacted yet. I agree with you that there's certainly an unusual character of the bipartisan nature of the concern about China. But I do think the underlying concern is warranted. I think China is essentially an existential threat to us and the West as a whole in this century. And their challenge is really across the board. It's not just political and military, although it's very much in those sectors. It's economic as well. Decades of stealing our intellectual property, discriminating against foreign investors and traders, manipulating the international financial system to its advantage. There's a lot that's gone on for a long time. We're just really beginning to appreciate and catch up to. So I think the bipartisan right. concern here is warranted.
Among others, he's talked to James Stravitas, of course, the former admiral, about a Pacific Rim build-out. I know that the United States has a new dialogue with the Philippines, among others. Does Bolton suggest that we need to rebuild out our military in the Pacific Rim, not just for Taiwan, but also for the South China Sea?
I think we need to rebuild it across the board. I think the next American president needs defense budget increases in the range of what Ronald Reagan did during his presidency, maybe even more. I think that implies even greater cuts to domestic spending to get our deficit down. But let's be clear, we've been asleep at the switch for a long time here. Going back to the end of the Cold War, people said it was the end of history. We had a peace dividend. We've got to put all that behind us. We face a very wide range of threats. Let's just take the Pacific. Get a map out that has the mm-hmm. Pacific Ocean in the middle of it. It's a long way away. We need probably 50 more naval war vessels right. in our fleet just to deal with the Pacific, let alone increases for the rest of the world.
And John Bolton, what's so important here is those of us of a certain vintage remember our intelligence misestimates of the Soviet Union. Do you have a confidence in our intelligence of China, or do we make the same misguiding that we did with the Soviet Union? Do we know what we're talking about with Beijing?
Well, I think we've got pretty good estimates on key areas. Some of it's visible to us already. Their capabilities for offensive cyber operations, for example, the military buildup that they've undertaken in anti-access area denial weapons to push us back from the western shores of the Pacific, their anti-satellite weapons capabilities to blind our eyes in the sky in time of crisis or conflict. That evidence is out there, as is the evidence of things like weaponizing what otherwise look like commercial companies, Huawei, ZTE. They're not telecommunications firms. Mm-hmm. They're arms of the Chinese state trying to take control of fifth-generation telecommunications.
That was John Bolton, former national security advisor to President Trump and former ambassador to the United Nations under President George W. Bush, with Bloomberg's Tom Keene.
And coming up,
the battle to cut auto emissions and what it means for oil companies like ConocoPhillips.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York.
Bloomberg 1130.
To Washington, D.C.
Bloomberg 991.
To Boston.
Bloomberg 1061.
To San Francisco.
Bloomberg 960.
To the country.
Sirius XM Channel 119.
And around the globe.
The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com.
This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini. At the White House this week unveiled what it is calling the toughest ever standards on auto emissions in U.S. history.
And Ali Zaidi, White House National Climate Advisor, says it's a balancing act right now when it comes to the environment, consumers, and the oil industry.
And here is Zaidi with Bloomberg's Anne-Marie Hordern and Joe Matthew.
You know, your Republican critics, who we hear from on a regular basis here on Balance of Power, say the Biden administration is trying to create some sort of artificial economy for EVs, that they're too expensive, that, you know, people need to have cheaper cars that are going to run on gas for longer than the administration is willing to admit. I wonder your response to that, as they suggest that you're at odds, you're actually enemies with the oil industry. How do you answer those critics?
The Biden administration has overseen a massive and unprecedented expansion in American energy and in American manufacturing. Every metric, we are growing the technologies, the capability to make those technologies, and the deployment that we need to boost our energy security, to cut consumer costs. The reality is, yeah, we are going to need a variety of fuel sources to get to where we need to go. There are vehicles that are going to run on gasoline for decades to come, because they've already been, in certain cases, purchased and going to just go. We need to meet those consumers where they are.
Doesn't that make the goals difficult to achieve, though?
I think the goals take into account reality. They take into account the techno-economics, and they take into account the incredible manufacturing renaissance that the president's unleashed. From congressional Republicans, though, let's see what they've put forward. H.R. 1, their signature piece of legislation, repeals big parts of the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, the VP was in Dalton, Georgia, just last week, announcing the expansion of a solar manufacturing facility in a district represented by someone who not only voted against the Inflation Reduction Act, which made that solar manufacturing possible, but wants to repeal it. So, you know, if we want to be for solutions, energy security, cutting consumer costs, boosting American manufacturing competitiveness, standing with the American worker and the American family, that's the president's investing in America agenda.
Do you find that the oil industry has a place in the clean energy transition?
We need the folks who have been working these oil fields to be part of this transformation. Right now, through the bipartisan infrastructure law, we actually have folks who are drilling wells, now capping abandoned wells that are leaking out methane all across the world. We have pipes that have been leaking methane. We are cutting that waste. And it's the same plumbers and pipe fitters union that put those pipes there in the first place that's helping patch it up. And when we look at some of these technologies and their deployment, there will be traditional energy workers who are going to absolutely be needed in that transformation. That's why on day one, the president launched this Energy Communities Working Group. At the cabinet level, I co-chair this group, but Department of Energy, Department of Labor, others, we're working on a community-by-community basis to make sure the electricians, the oil and gas workers, the coal workers are all at the front of the line as we take on the climate crisis.
That was Ali Zaidi, White House National Climate Advisor, with Bloomberg's Anne-Marie Hordern and Joe Matthew.
And speaking of oil, Ed, at electric vehicles, Ryan Lance, chair and CEO of ConocoPhillips, says he doesn't think the Biden administration's plans to cut emissions really add up when you think about it.
And here he is with us in an exclusive interview with our Alex Steele at the New York Stock Exchange.
The EPA is announcing new EV rules for trucks and for cars. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, that's a real hit for fossil fuel demand.
Well, I mean, it's an ambitious goal. What I would say is to go back to what a lot of us have been saying for a long time is the permitting challenge is going to be tough to execute those kinds of goals. So somehow the administration and Congress is going to have to address the permitting challenge. You just can't get there under this sort of system. It's a bit prohibitive. So I think they're ambitious goals, and they move us in that kind of a direction. But without permitting reform, it's hard to see how you can accomplish the infrastructure required to get there.
Do you read that, though, as like an administration being anti-fossil fuels when they also need you? Like, how do you interpret that?
Well, I think it's a stated goal of the administration to try to move the agenda a bit on the energy transition and speed that up. I don't worry about it from our business side, just because I do the math and I do how hard it is. You cannot power our country on renewables alone. And you're going to need fossil fuels, and we're going to need it for a long period of time. Our job in our industry is to do that more sustainably. It's to take care of flaring, it's to take care of methane, and it's to take care of orphaned wells. And this industry is on that. We're doing that. Our company is doing that. And as we announced an improvement in our greenhouse gas emissions reduction initiative. So we went from a 40% to 50% reduction to a 50% to 60% reduction by 2030. That's what we need to do in our business to make sure that we're sustainable as an oil and gas company.
There is a conversation evolving in the market that if you're not investing in growing production, I appreciate that you're looking at a compound annual growth rate of 4% to 5% over the next 10 years of production, but if you're not growing it, you're in effect liquidating the company and setting itself up to be bought. Is that a view that you guys talk about? Is that true?
You know, it's not true for our company.
Right.
I mean, we're certainly building for the future and developing a portfolio through our LNG investments, through longer cycle projects like Willow in Alaska. We're certainly looking at it for the long haul for the decade. But yeah, certainly there's a bunch of privates that are drilling very, very quickly. And I think that's what characterizes the transactions probably over the last 6 to 12 months. In our opinion, a high degree of PDP are producing sort of reserves and cash flow, not a lot of running room on investments. And I think a number of the companies have put themselves into that situation. So you have to ask yourself, what is their end game?
Exactly. And to that point, and then you add in the potential M&A, does it bring forward the peak Permian conversation in terms of production, or does it extend it?
I think it probably extends it a little bit as people are trying to figure out what happens. So, you know, it could be later this decade or early the next decade, but the Permian will peak at some point in time and start to plateau. Mm-hmm. And that should be a concern for policymakers in the United States as well, because the market share of OPEC will grow at that point in time. And we saw what happened here. The Saudis made a decision to cut back production, and OPEC Plus Group followed suit. And you can see what happens to the market when those things kind of happen. So I think policymakers should be worried about what happens to the structure of this business in the United States.
I'll ask that question in a second, but just one more. Do you think there's anywhere in the U.S., and I know you're going to say Alaska, but anywhere in the U.S. that you think we can really grow production aside from the Permian? You've been committed to Alaska for a long time. So anywhere else, everywhere else?
Well, we're pretty stable in the Bakken. Mm-hmm. Our Eagleford is growing. Mm-hmm. Our Eagleford continues to grow at a slower rate than the Permian. But yeah, as we look around, the Permian is the spot. Now, some of the gas production could grow in the Marcellus and the Haynesville, but that gets back to an infrastructure problem.
Totally.
So there are opportunities to grow on the gas side, but it's going to take a comprehensive energy policy to try to figure out how to make a lot of that happen.
Like deep water,
but the primary
you think?
Growth. Deep water can. You know, certainly the province has gotten its cost of supply down a little bit, but it's still challenged on the permitting side, and it is a higher cost of supply basin in our opinion. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take more sustained higher prices for a longer period of time to probably incent a lot of new development there.
How high is your hurdle for any reentry into deep water in a big way?
Well, we're pretty satisfied with what we got today,
okay,
Alex. We exited the deep water a number of years ago, just saw the cost of supply of that basin or that kind of opportunity didn't compete well with what we were trying to build in the unconventional space. So
to OPEC, Was that your read of the OPEC cut, that we are now dependent again on the Saudis instead of U.S. guys?
You know, I'm not so sure. I think, they look at it and they see a supply problem probably, and they see a bit of slower demand growth coming out of China post-COVID. So I think there's probably some underlying fundamental reasons why they've done what they've done. But it just shows sort of how the market is going to react to very small movements in supply. And I think that just indicates how balanced the system is. Inventories are quite low. The system is really balanced. So any bobble up in demand or bobble down in supply is going to drive prices.
And that was Ryan Lance, Chair and CEO of ConocoPhillips, in an exclusive interview with Bloomberg's Alex Steele at the New York Stock Exchange.
And coming up,
Jeremy Hunt, UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, on why he's more positive than others who gathered this past week for IMF and World Bank meetings in Washington.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
Denise, a lot of forecasts about the economy from all the movers and shakers we spoke to at this week's World Bank and International Monetary Fund spring meetings.
Pierre Olivier Garancha is chief economist at the International Monetary Fund.
Inflation is much stickier than anticipated, even a few months ago. While global inflation has declined, this reflects mostly the sharp reversal in energy and food prices. But core inflation, excluding energy and food prices, has still not peaked in many countries.
Meanwhile, UK Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt tells our Maria Tadeo he's a little more optimistic than some others in spite of challenging domestic politics.
I do want to go into the IMF forecast because they have upgraded the contraction. So it's not going to be as severe this year, but they also say for next year's 1% growth. Is that acceptable to you? Is there a fundamental growth problem in the UK? Or actually, do you believe, well, the IMF is wrong, we're going to do better than this?
Well, we will do better than that.
They are wrong. Our
forecasts are significantly better than the IMF forecast. But what I should say is that last year we were the fastest growing economy in the G7.
But why is there this gap then?
Well, I think, it's not just me. I mean, the German finance minister says he's much more optimistic about Germany's prospects. I think Janet Yellen has said the same about the United States.
So you say we will prove
We are very confident about the UK's medium and longer term prospects, but we don't pretend that we're not going through a difficult period. Like everyone, we're dealing with very high inflation, which we have to bring down. That means interest rates are higher. But you look at an economy and you say, what are the sectors that are going to make the biggest difference, that are going to shape the 21st century? And it's technology, it's life sciences, it's entertainment industries. Those are the industries where the UK has the biggest sector in Europe, and that gives us great hope for the future.
Well, you also have a potential, a trade deal with the EU. There had been tensions with the EU, potential tariffs that could come into play. That, we believe, is not going to happen now with the Windsor framework. But I do wonder, when is this going to be fully clarified for investors? Because still, it's not been fully sealed.
Well, the Windsor framework has been agreed.
But in Northern Ireland, you don't have still confirmation this is going through, and they have to agree to this.
We are committed to the Windsor framework. It will go through. What we don't have in Northern Ireland, the relationship with the EU, the trading that's going to happen between the rest of the UK and Northern Ireland, that is settled with the Windsor framework, and that removes a major irritant in our relations with the EU.
You've had a difficult job to inherit, and as you say, it has been a difficult year for the UK, but I wonder if you believe all of this has come together, you're going to see this economy grow. To me, what it sounds is that you want to be in a good shape for next year, and obviously the timing is around the election. Do you want to see an early election, or do you want to see a late election in the year when perhaps all of this will come into fruition, if you believe you're right?
Well, it's too soon to answer that question.
You don't want to put a season on it. Maybe it's the autumn.
What I would say is that if you look at the projections, not just by the IMF, but by the official forecasters in the UK, by the Bank of England, they are that in a year's time, the UK economy will really have turned a corner. And the single reason for that is that we are predicted to get inflation down to 3% or below. And that is the single...
Do you believe you can hit that number? Because the IMF also says on the fiscal side, they have questions about some of your targets.
Yeah, but they also believe we can hit that number. And I believe we can get inflation under control, but I don't underestimate the challenge, because just as in the United States and the EU, core inflation, underlying inflation, is still between 4 and 6%. So there's still a lot of work to do.
And that was UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, with Bloomberg's Maria Tadeo, from the sidelines of the spring gatherings of the IMF and World Bank meetings in Washington. And another round of IMF and World Bank meetings is coming soon, the big annual meetings for both. Well, those will be in October. We'll have live special coverage from those as well, interviewing more movers and shakers across the globe for you. And the annual meetings of the IMF and World Bank coming up, Ed. Well, those will be in Morocco, in the city of Marrakesh.
Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? They're taking me to Marrakesh.
And that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Best. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And this is Bloomberg. Stay with us. Top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.